Well, welcome, you guys, to chapter 4 in the ongoing saga of Lamentations. Yeah, I want you guys to know it's been quite a challenge to come up with warm fuzzies in the book of Lamentations. I'm doing my best, you know, but I've already got three or four people holding out for real jelly donut. I got mugged in the foyer just a little while ago. It's coming. Well, let's see, Lamentations 4. Now, this is interesting. Let's just take a peek where we are. If you're new with us tonight, we've been in Lamentations about 3 weeks. This is our fourth, chapter 4. And basically what has happened, we're looking at Jerusalem, right at just days, if you will, after the Babylonian Empire has come and basically nuked Jerusalem. There's almost not a stone left on top of each other. If there do happen to be a couple of survivors, they have crawled under a rock somewhere and are just trembling down in there. Jeremiah, in chapter 1, sort of the picture I have in my mind as I'm reading, he comes over the hill from his little village northeast of Jerusalem and just witnesses, sees the desolation. Chapter 2, he's actually down in the ghost town that was Jerusalem, the jewel of the world, and he really proceeds into a flashback where the screams and the horror and the bloodshed are revisited into his mind immediately. In the midst of this flashback, chapter 3 delivers us to a wonderful thing where suddenly at the bottom of the pit, the lowest a guy can go, Jeremiah remembers that, but God's loving kindness is forever. His mercies never cease. It's a wonderful chapter. It was that's what got me into trouble with the jelly and the donut. I kept promising everybody when we got to the middle chapter, it would be good. Well, it was good. And remember, that is how, in Hebrew poetry, the prophets and the authors drew your attention to the central idea, God's faithfulness, his loving kindness, his chesed, his covenant love. He puts that in the very middle of the story so that you won't miss it. It's right, it's in the middle of the picture frame. And that's how they understood these things. So that was chapter 3. Well, chapter 4, he kind of drifts out of that remembrance and he kind of gets mournful again. And what we're going to see is he embarks on rather a mournful meditation, not so much on the horror of the siege and the takeover, but on the failure of the people. Everywhere he looks, they have, whether because of the siege or just because of their spiritual poverty, they have fallen down, they've decayed and degenerated, they're abusing each other, they're greedy, the elders have become embarrassments to the nation. So this is kind of a painful introspection on Jeremiah's part. And we're going to get into it. Before we do, though, I just want to review real quickly the applications that we did get out of chapter 3 last week. The first was to examine your ways. And we talked about this in terms of finding the sin within you the first week. Don't play with the skunk. You kind of remember that. But last week, we were looking a little bit more at interpersonal sins, behavioral sins against other people. And the prevalence of even American Christians, even one or two Christians here, maybe, and I have nobody in particular in mind, who will behave one way at church and then just behave in shockingly different ways out in the world the rest of the week. And I kind of laid into that and said, don't ever let that happen. And even gave you a test. If you have a question, if your behavior is good and Christian, bring it to church on Sunday and try it out on us. And I guarantee you will learn whether or not it's Christian. We'll do a good job of evaluating it for you and teaching you about it. Well, examine your ways, endure your trials, no surprise there, expect them. That's part of your job description. Jesus said it, John said it, Peter said it, Paul said it. It's kind of why you're here. If everything's hunky-dory, You just don't present that impressive a picture of a disciple. If things are bad and you are still taking joy in life and being kind to people, that makes people sit up. Satan can't counterfeit that. That's a special currency that only you as a believing Christian have. So I just encourage you, take the trials. Don't be afraid of them. You don't have to enjoy them. Jesus didn't enjoy his. Just take the trials, lean into them, and remember that God will rescue you, and he will bring good out of every mile of suffering. He just doesn't waste that. All of it is for his purpose. So examine your ways, endure your trials. If you do that, you may readily expect your deliverance, just as we were praying at the opening. You guys, this ends well. If you trust Christ, I don't care what happens here. I don't care how bad it seems. And your life might be a horror movie beyond understanding. But as Paul says, the things that we undergo here are just really light affliction. Now, I don't understand that completely. It seems pretty vivid and terrible to me when it happens. But what he's saying is, don't panic when it happens. You are going to be delivered. You really are a mega lottery winner. You're just waiting for the check to clear, literally. It's as if the entire stimulus package were a check written out in your name. It's better than that. So live in that reality. When the trials come your way, just say, gosh, I can't wait till this is over. And know that it will be, and it will be good. Well, review of structure. Again, we don't have to talk about parallelism or any of the Hebrew poetry structures. I think we've done that enough. We're about to get into chapter 4, which is, as verse 1 and 3 was, a 22-verse acrostic. Remember, chapter 3 was our gigantic 66-verse triple acrostic with the chrome and the edges and the dingle balls, man, on the rearview mirror. Well, what we want to do, more than anything, I want to talk about what we call imprecation tonight. That's a great word. You can impress everybody at your next cocktail party with that one. Imprecation means to curse. And you'll notice at the end of chapter 1, what was Jeremiah doing? What was Jerusalem's voice, but basically Jeremiah was writing, and Lord, hang my enemies up like a gutted pig and visit it on them. And same thing with chapter 3. And we look at that today as Christians go, whoa, it's a little harsh. It is. You're not used to that. But the ancient writers, that was a very popular motif in ancient literature and even in the Bible. My gosh, there's a bunch of the Psalms, I think I counted 9 or 10 this evening, that are called imprecatory Psalms. They are an invocation to God to bring down justice on my enemies. And they're not PG-13, you guys. They're nasty. I mean, David even uses them. I don't want you to be too hard on Jeremiah. I don't want you to be too hard on the Old Testament Hebrews. This was, remember, they had grown up under the law. They were used to this, what we call, I know you've heard it before, talionic law, the eye for the eye, the tooth for the tooth. That's how they understood justice. And by spending centuries under the law, you know, I think it's fair to say that they got a little thick-skinned. They got a little calloused. One, they were allured by rule-keeping, and that's what they set their hearts on, and they kind of forgot God's original purpose, which was to love God with all your heart and your neighbor as yourself. So if it seems a little harsh, whether you're reading the imprecatory Psalms or the ending of chapters 1, 3, and 4 in Lamentations, please understand that's where they were coming from. This is the mechanism God taught them to scale and measure justice by. So just in your hearts, don't condemn them for that. Jesus hadn't arrived yet to fulfill and correct their understanding. And just for fun, I want to tell you, he has arrived to fulfill and correct our understanding. You remember in Matthew 5 where he says, "You've heard it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. And I think he's actually thinking about David in Psalm 139. He says, but I say to you, love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you. Gosh, you guys, that's radical stuff today. I mean, back then it was mind-blowing to a culture, the Hebrew culture, that had grown up with the imprecatory idea. This was mind-blowing. And he's still blowing minds, that guy. So understand, when you hear Jeremiah curse Edom at the end of this chapter, please just kind of retreat to your modern Christian understanding and say, well, it was biblical. God really did indeed curse Edom. But if Jeremiah were here today, reading what Jesus had taught us, he probably would have ended that chapter a little differently. So here we are, we're moving out of the eye of the storm. Remember, we talked about coming through the wall of the hurricane in chapters 1 and 2, into the eye of the storm in chapter 3. Well, we're moving back into the other side of the hurricane in chapter 4. And we'll pick it up right there. Chapter 4, verse 1. How dark the gold has become, how the pure gold has changed. And we know that gold doesn't tarnish, so we're thinking he means soiled here. Dusty, bloody. King James calls it dimmed. That could be. The sacred stones, maybe the jewels of the ephod, are poured out, scattered and spilled at the corner of every street. So there's wreckage here. The treasures of the temple are what has been missed by the looting Babylonians is just strewn every place in the ruins. Verse 2, the precious sons of Zion weighed against or comparable to fine gold, how they are regarded as earthen jars, the work of a potter's hand. And, you know, we think of pottery. Actually, you go down to Pier 1 Imports, you spend a lot of money on that stuff. You guys, in these days, remember, pottery was cheap, cheap, cheap. You could get treasured artifacts, as Paul speaks, the vessels of honor that are all painted nice, but this is like chinette. This is paper plates. Every village had 20 potters because everybody needed this stuff all the time. They broke all the time. So when he compares the sons of Israel to just pottery, he is saying from fine gold, they're worthless. They're just trashed. 3, even jackals offer the breast. They nurse their young. But the daughter of my people has become cruel like ostriches in the wilderness. Okay, got to stop there with the ostrich. Ya'ana, the ostrich, which until two nights ago, I had no idea ever even existed in the Holy Land. Apparently they did at some point. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with the nesting habits of ostrich, but to get the idea of what this comparison means, ostriches will live in a group. They have an alpha male and an alpha female. The alpha female will lay her 10 eggs in the center of a big communal nest, and all the other girls get in and they lay their eggs around the edges. Well, big mama gets in there and she kicks this egg out and that egg out, you know, and maybe one chick out of 30 eggs will survive and hatch, if that. Possibly two, but that's rare. Now, the Israelis have seen this in the desert, in the wilderness, up in the mountains, and so it's easy as pie for them simply to conclude, wow, the ostrich is a lousy mom. Well, yeah, she is a lousy mom. So when they're saying that, they mean a mother that just casts her children out, doesn't even care about them. And that's what he's calling Israel. The tongue of the infant cleaves to the roof of its mouth because of thirst. The little ones ask for bread, but no one breaks it for them. So the babies are thirsty. Remember, even in the siege, Hezekiah dug a tunnel. The city has plenty of water, even in a siege. So what does this mean? Well, one, maybe mom just went dry. That's a good possibility. But it could be much worse than that. It could simply mean the baby's just left in the corner of the room to die. I don't know if you've ever really been thirsty. I mean, seriously scary thirsty. but your tongue really does stick to the top of your mouth. It's like flypaper when it comes off. I don't know how to describe the feeling. It's very bizarre. You don't want to experience it if you can help it. And the little ones ask for bread, but no one breaks it for them. Same thing. Maybe there's just no bread, but maybe these are orphans running the streets, and there's not a chance. People are hoarding their bread. The kids just got to go hungry. 5, those who ate delicacies are desolate in the streets, and those reared in purple embrace ash pits. So those that had lots of baklava are now desolate's an interesting word. Shamam, it means astonished, appalled. It means these folks that were used to eating the fancy stuff, they're not only out in the streets, they're still shocked by this. They can't believe that they're having to eat garbage. And those reared in purple, you guys know the thing with purple, the royal color. Remember that, gosh, I think it's something like 12,000 little snails to make 1 gram of purple. I mean, it was incredibly expensive. It was made in Tyre. The Phoenicians made it. So who can afford that? Kings, emperors, you know, or maybe the grand vizier. So if you saw somebody in purple, that was definitely... You know what? Today, we could replace this and say, you could put Armani or Gucci. You know, those reared in Gucci, those reared in Armani, exactly the same thing. Whoa, that's some big movie star, some political powerhouse. Well, they embrace ash pits, and that's a very polite term. What it really means is a cesspit. It's a dung pit. That's not a pretty picture. 6, for the iniquity of the daughter of my people is greater than the sin of Sodom. Now, that's interesting. Sodom was a pretty nasty place. But if you think about it, Sodom was guilty of simple idolatry and immorality. Israel is guilty of spiritual adultery, and he's not happy about it. If you think about it, in one way, Sodom kind of got off easy. A couple seconds of terror, a couple meteors and fire and brimstone, it's all gone. It's all done. Jerusalem had to pay the price basically for years and years and years. So the Lord is not happy with these folks. Sodom, which was overthrown as in a moment and no hands were turned toward her. There's a little bit of interpretive question here. It's either no hands were turned to help Zion or that Sodom perhaps was destroyed without a hand. I'll leave you to your own Bible study to figure that out. Her consecrated ones, Jerusalem's consecrated ones, were purer than snow. They were whiter than milk. Now this word is Nazir, and you guys heard of the Nazarites, right? John the Baptist? The Nazarite, they were dedicated to the Lord. That's how we usually interpret this word. It kind of means uncut vine. It just means something we give to God and we just leave it alone, let it grow crazy. But because of the context, that doesn't seem to fit, you know, brighter than snow, whiter, more dazzling than milk. So what the commentators have said, this probably means the rulers of Jerusalem, the princes. So her princes were pure, brighter than snow, and more dazzling than milk, ruddy in body than corals. Their polishing was like lapis lazuli. If you've ever seen lapis, it's a really beautiful stone, really shiny, dark black with a hint of deep blue in it. It's really mesmerizing. It's fascinating. So basically, the princes, up till now, have just been some seriously beautiful people. I mean, dazzling in appearance, just unbelievably coiffed and dressed. Their appearance now is blacker than soot, blacker than blackness. They're not recognized in the street. Their skin is shriveled on their bones. It's withered. It's become like wood, dry and hard. Better are those slain with the sword than those slain with hunger, for they pine away, being stricken for lack of the fruits of the field. The hands of compassionate women cooked their own children. They became food for them because of the destruction of the daughter of my people. And if these are the hands of compassionate women, merciful, tender-hearted women, you can imagine, you know, I don't need to draw you a picture of what's happening down the street where the family's not quite so together. This is really a bad time. If you want to ask me afterwards, I got a whole list of where cannibalism under siege is listed in the Bible. Gosh, we have been insulated from a lot of real life, you guys. You know, when we complain about our trials, gracious goodness. Verse 11, the Lord has accomplished his wrath. And this word, kala, means finished, perfected. I mean, gracious, what else is there to do? It can't be any worse. Interestingly, this is actually related to the Greek word teleosis that the Lord uses to the rich young ruler. If you want to be perfect, if you want to be completed, give all your stuff away and follow me. So it's the end product of a process. And the end product of the Lord's wrath is this smoking ruin that Jerusalem has become. He's poured out his fierce anger. He's kindled a fire in Zion, which has consumed, eaten its foundations. The kings of the earth did not believe, nor did any of the inhabitants of the world, that the adversary and enemy could enter the gates of Jerusalem. In fairness, this is a little bit of hyperbole. The Jeremiah knows better. This is kind of an exaggeration just to underscore the surprise of it. I mean, it was just 100 years ago that one of the kings of Israel came in and knocked down 600 feet of wall. But there were a lot of stories too about miraculous savings. You guys remember when Sennacherib showed up outside with his army of Assyrians in 2 Kings 19? And they woke up the next day and the Assyrians are all dead, and Sennacherib, he books home. So there are miraculous savings, and the people had come to count on that. Whether their worship was true or not, they had really started to lean on the fact that, you know, oh, it's God's city. He's not going to let anything happen to God's city. We can do whatever we want, but God's city is safe because he's not going to let anything bad happen to it. Well, that didn't work out so well for them. Because of the sins of her prophets and the iniquities of her priests, who have shed in her midst the blood of the righteous. This is also a very interesting verse, you guys. What this is saying to us is that people in positions of power and influence, if they are given over to dishonesty and corruption, they carry Levitical blood guilt as if they had murdered someone. That's what the Lord's saying here. God, the priests didn't go around shedding people's blood in Jerusalem. But because they were corrupt, they did accept bribes, they did compromise the worship of God, God is laying the full blood guilt on them because certainly people died, their mortgages were foreclosed, things bad happened to them. The Lord's visiting the full sack of consequences at their feet. They wandered, staggered, blind in the streets, and we're to understand this is the priests and the prophets referred to, perhaps symbolizing all of the people. They were defiled with blood so that no one could touch their garments. Depart, unclean! It says they cried of themselves. Several other versions, NIV, King James, say people cried of them, which actually seems to make a little bit more sense. Either way, they are a sad case because they are Levitically unclean, and anybody that touches them is unclean. So you can't help them. You can't even push them out of the house. You can't get near them. Depart unclean, they cried of themselves. Depart, depart, do not touch. So they fled and wandered, and men among the nations said, they shall not continue to dwell with us. Not only are they unclean, they have truly become an embarrassment. They're a disgust. Their failure is very obvious to everyone. The presence of the Lord has scattered them. He will not continue to regard them. Means he won't even observe them. He won't look upon them. They did not honor the priests. They did not favor the elders. meaning the Babylonians. And again, there's a difference in interpretation. You could also say the Lord. He did not honor the priests. He did not favor the elders. Yet our eyes failed. Looking for help was useless. In our watching, we have waited for a nation that could not save. This is just one of the complacent things Jerusalem fell into. Well, you know, we've got Egypt in our back pocket. They don't want Babylon to own Judea any more than we do. So Egypt will come to our rescue. That sure didn't work out. And we get another couple gruesome ones. They hunted our steps. And picture, gosh, this is a great movie scene. You know, out of a horror movie, the young kids are hiding, you know, in the closet or behind something, and you can hear in the background the hunter, the evil homicidal maniac prowling around. He's just waiting to hear a breath or a footfall. So they hunted our steps so that we couldn't even walk in the streets. This is the people, whoever's surviving, they are under deep cover. It's amazing that the Babylonians missed them the first time through. Our end drew near. Our days were finished, for our end had come. This is just a hopeless situation. They can't breathe. They can't move. They can't do anything. Our pursuers were swifter than the eagles of the sky. They chased us on the mountains. They waited in ambush for us in the wilderness. And the chased verb there is, again, one of the aggressive ones, dalak. It's what David's men did after he killed Goliath. And they just chased down the Philistines, just slaughtered them. Just came up behind them, ran up behind them, slaughtered them as they were escaping. I mean, it's merciless. It's butchery. And that's what the Babylonians are doing to survivors right now. The breath, the Hebrew ruach, life spirit, really, of our nostrils, the Lord's anointed. And here, they're referring to King Zedekiah. He wasn't popular. It's not that they liked him, but he was important because Zedekiah, the breath of our nostrils, the Lord's anointed, was captured in their pits, of whom we had said, under his shadow, we shall live among the nations. Yet another false hope. Zedekiah symbolized to the people their connection to King David's line. If they lose Zedekiah, where are they going to get the Messiah from? That's what they're thinking. Zedekiah, you can't kill him. He's our connection to the Messiah. So when Zedekiah is, you know, blinded and taken off to Babylon where he dies, this is almost the last straw. And it's interesting because Jeremiah, who possibly could have known better, the Spirit doesn't seem to have informed him, but Jeremiah kind of goes along with this. There's not a lot of messianic content in Jeremiah's commentary here. You almost feel like Jeremiah's going along with this, thinking, oh man, with Zedekiah gone, we're stuck. What are we going to do? Well, rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom. And again, this is one of those great things that we lose in translation. Sus vasamak, O daughter of Edom. And it is Edom, and we'll talk about them, but really Edom is just first among many. It's representative of all the enemies of Israel that have been sitting around watching this whole drama unfold. And some of them even helped. As a matter of fact, it is said that Edom not only provided diplomatic and commercial assistance, it is thought that Edom's troops showed up at the end to help destroy Jerusalem. What is pretty much, I think the archaeologists have decided, is there's a lot of evidence that the Edomites kind of abandoned their kingdom and moved directly into Judea when the Babylonians emptied it. Just for fun, you guys remember the kingdom of Edom? Anybody like a 10-minute refresher on where the kingdom of Edom is? It's picture, just for fun. So I get these things mixed up. You know, Edom, Moab, huh, what? Edom, if you go down to the very bottom of the Dead Sea and you look over if you could look over the 1,500-foot cliffs. If you look directly towards the Mediterranean to the west, you're kind of in line with Beersheba. That line between Beersheba and the bottom of the Dead Sea, roughly Judea, roughly Israel. Everything below it, the whole Dead Sea Valley below that, all the way to the Gulf of Aqaba, and 100 miles on either side, is Edom. It's big. It's a big kingdom. And at this time, it was at its peak. They have been waiting like vultures for this. And so they're going to get what they asked for. Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom, who dwells in the land of Uz. But the cup will come around to you as well. You will become drunk and make yourself naked. In other words, Edom, you have the opportunities now, but you're going to waste them. You're going to take these riches in our land, and you're going to fritter them away, and you're going to be ashamed very soon too. You're going to be overthrown. Verse 22, the punishment of your iniquity has been completed, O daughter of Zion. He will exile you no longer. Exile, galah, to uncover. He will uncover you no more. But he will punish your iniquity, O daughter of Edom. He will expose your sins. Again, galah, he will uncover your sins. Same word here. So it's Jerusalem's turn is over. The worst has happened. They're done. Now it's just a recovery period for them. Coming is Edom's turn. And it's very interesting. As a nation, the Edomites disappear about now. They move up into Judea, take over Judah's land, Israel's land, obviously with the blessing of the Babylonians. And what happens is we don't really deal with them as the nation of Edom anymore. What is thought is they become absorbed into the various populations of Arabs, which would be in keeping with the children of Esau. That's pretty much what's going on there. And interestingly enough, another Arab tribe comes in to fill what was Edom, called the Nabataeans. They're the guys that carved Petra out. They were the caravan and water masters, and eventually had Christian kings before they were subjugated by the Roman Empire. So that's just a whole interesting time. So the Edomites kind of disappear, but Esau's progeny through the Semitic people, through the Arabs, ends up fulfilling the prophecies we read against Edom in Isaiah 34, Jeremiah 49, Ezekiel 35. Ezekiel even prophesies that, you guys, this will never be a good place. Edom will always be a desolation, a wasteland. The people who will live there will be the hawks and the kites. And you guys, that is true today. Even with Israel pumping millions of dollars into development and Jordan doing their best, man, you can drive through that country, and that's some of the meanest, nastiest country I've ever seen on the planet. It's just wicked. It's just unfriendly, and it's that way today. Probably the definitive treatment, if you really want to get the Lord's bottom line on Edom, is read Obadiah. It's just a teeny little short book. It's probably the shortest. Is it the shortest, Rick? Do you remember? It's the shortest in the Old Testament. So, I mean, you could do that over lunch. But Obadiah catalogs and details what's wrong with Edom. And Edom's bottom line is pride. That's what hurt them here. They just stood with their hands on their hips and watched as Jerusalem was gobbled up by the Babylonian Empire. And it's always been their problem. There was their pride when they first didn't let Israel and her children go through on the Exodus to the Promised Land. So Edom's problem is pride. They paid for it. They are paying for it. I mean, if you want to stretch it and apply it to, say, the Islamic world today, gosh, pride is at the heart of Islam. It's all about works. Still is. So it's interesting. God's analysis, God's curse, those things don't go away. They do exactly what they're supposed to. Well, let's go ahead and draw some application from this. Boy, again, you know, warm fuzzies. I'm at a loss to come up with some warm fuzzies on some of this. But what we can do is we can use the example of this horror in a negative way and draw some negative applications. And the first one that I would give us as we close up is, don't be complacent. Jerusalem got in trouble because they got used to the routine. Just like, you know, the frog being boiled in the water, you throw him in, he jumps out, you just leave him in there and slowly turn up the heat. Just little increment by little increment, Jerusalem just kind of degraded, her spiritual worship degraded. You know, I actually think in my mind that it was never so blatant to them, the change, that they were really aware of it. It just got down to a point, I think a godly person would have looked around and noticed something, but they were in the flesh, and it got so bad, they just got used to it. They got depending on, my gosh, the security blanket of the Davidic lineage we were talking about. They just, whoa, God can't get rid of us. You know, hey, we're the children of the promise. They said the same thing to Jesus, remember? We're the children of the promise. We're here for good. In the past history of Jerusalem's inviolability, even though that was kind of rank, they trusted the empty fulfillment of the temple sacrifices. They were so proud of the temple. Again, they thought, no, we have the oracles. We have the temple. We have the temple services. God can't get rid of that. Well, he did. It was empty worship. And he said in several places, you guys, I'm not impressed. You honor me with your lips, but your hearts are far from me. That's a warning to us. And they also were complacent in depending on the promised support of their earthly allies. You guys, all of that was smoke and mirrors. All of that was illusion, and it disappeared when the first Babylonian soldier showed up at the gates. It just went out the window. So for us, don't invest over much in the stability, the seeming stability and steadiness of what you know right now. You know, you may be in a relationship you've had for 40 years. You may be living in the house you've been in for 30 years. You may be working in the job that you've had for 30 years. You might have gone here since we built the old sanctuary. You know, all of this, you guys, it's gone in an instant. It's just, we are perched on a razor's edge all the time. It doesn't seem that way to us. We get really used to things being the way they are, you know, and we do take for granted our relationships, our situations, the things that God has given us. Just always be aware, they belong to him, and you won't find any lasting comfort and shelter in them. Be prepared for a tree to fall on your house. Be prepared to lose someone you love. Be prepared for the boss to come in and hand you a pink slip after 35 years of hard labor. This stuff happens. It's happening all around us. You've seen it, my gosh, the last couple months. Don't trust what isn't trustworthy. We, of all people, shouldn't be complacent. There's only one place to put your trust. There's only one thing that'll hold something that heavy and precious, and that's the bedrock of Jesus Christ and what he purchased for us. That's where to put your trust. So live in that, and if the cyclone comes, well, do your best to dodge it, and after it's gone, say, whoa, that really sucked. I hope that doesn't happen again. But don't be thrown by that. Don't let your faith be robbed by that. That's just part and parcel of living here. In the old days, it was even worse. That's kind of one problem here in America. We've kind of got used to things being pretty fat and easy. It's not that way in reality. Be ready for that. I suspect, and this is not a prophecy, but I'm thinking we're going to see more of that, guys. In the next few years, I think you're going to see more of that. So please don't grow complacent. Second, could almost title the whole thing this, don't grow weary. One of the mistakes Israel made And this is kind of what let them start to slip. They grew weary in doing good. They grew weary in examining their hearts. They grew weary in offering true worship because it's hard. It means looking at yourself. It means being honest. And they got tired of that. And little by little, they kind of got seduced. Oh, yeah, well, we're offering the worship and we're doing this and that and all the good things that he wrote to us in his word. The problem is, you know, one little compromise here, then another little compromise over there, and in 20 years, you're worshiping a golden calf. How did we get here? It happens that way. You know, if you're kind of an old person like me, you've watched that happen in our culture over the last 50 years. It's just a very interesting process. So be aware that it happens. And in your walk, don't grow weary. Don't give up doing good. What happened to Jerusalem is they trusted what they could see and feel. And so when those things got torn to pieces in the cyclone of Babylonian invasion, they had nothing to hope in. They were trusting in what they could see and feel. And it just went away like dust. And when it was gone, they just lost all hope, and they degenerated into animals. They hoarded their food. You know, they hurt their neighbors. They ate their children. And I know it was terrible. And I know in these situations, we can be pressed to some pretty hideous things. But, you know, you read some of the accounts of Christians in the Nazi concentration camps, it'll blow your mind. They would offer their lives when someone else was threatened. You know, a chicken got stolen out of the commandant's kitchen, and here this poor terrified person that's guilty, and the Christian would say, I did it. That was me. Christians don't lose this when times are hard. They don't get weary. When you lose, when all the sensory reasons for behaving well are torn from you, and the only reason you have left is because there's no godly alternative, you're going to have a taste of what it was like to climb up Mount Calvary. Because that's what Jesus did. I'm sure he's looking at that little pinpoint of laser light in the future that says, I'm just going to do this because I know what's going to come from it. And I'm going to rescue all my brothers and sisters. And he just, foot by foot, one step in front of another, we can do that too. Because God will meet us in those places, you guys. If we did take a show of hands, I know he's a bunch of you people would raise hands because he already has. You know he has. He has me. He will be there for you in that Calvary moment. So set your face like flint. Just say, I don't care what it feels like. I don't care how bad it seems. I'm just driving ahead because I see the light right up there, and that's where I need to go. Don't grow weary, guys. Now, Galatians 6:9, I like that one. Let us not lose heart in doing good, for in due time we shall reap it if we do not grow weary. Well, don't grow complacent. Don't grow weary. And probably one of the most important ones, don't grow bitter. Israel, even Jeremiah, they had every opportunity, every reason to be bitter, and they did. They grew bitter. I shared this at the single women's dinner the other night. We have a loved family member that, not a believer, but every time someone offends him, he crosses their name off his list. You get one chance. That's what you get. And you're off the list. And he'll be civil to you if he meets you in Walmart, you know, but no, I don't hang out with him. Oh, you should have heard what they did to me. I've known him for 30 years. Do you know what his list looks like now? There's maybe, I don't know if there's a half dozen people left. And you know, it's funny, they're all Christians. So if you let that root of bitterness, if you don't rip that out of there, if you don't choose to forgive, you guys, it doesn't just stay still. It hurts you. It grows. It is as cancerous as anything we fight in the hospitals today. It's an evil thing. It gets inside, and what's scary is when you grab a hold of it and hold it real tight, it feels good. And the endorphins go and your rage comes up. I still, even people I've forgiven, I'll be driving along, going to school or something, you know, through that horrible flat stretch between Eugene and Springfield, you know, there's nothing to think about. And all of a sudden, I'll just start ruminating and I'll remember, you know, that, oh yeah, I remember when he said that. By the time I'm at Springfield, I'm ready to drive around, turn around, go and beat him to death with a stick of firewood, and I forgave him 30 years ago. It's, you guys, this stuff is evil. You have to go after it. You have to weed it. The way to do it is to choose to forgive a person and then act as though you have forgiven them. And every time it rises in your mind again, choose to forgive them again. Just remember, oh, you know, I've already forgiven that person. And you know what? It gets easier with time. Thank God for giving you the ability to forgive. I mean, step out, appropriate it in faith, and it will happen. It's like pumping iron. You get better and better and better at it. And God will meet your lack. Now, just for fun, I should qualify this and say, that doesn't mean you have to trust everyone you forgive. Winning back trust is a whole different issue. There are people I've forgiven who I do trust who have won it back, and there are people who I will never again make myself vulnerable to. And that's fair. I still love them, and I have forgiven them. But it's just, that's discernment, that's wisdom. But forgiving them, here's what happens. It takes you out of being the guy that has to balance the scales of justice. That's not our job. Jeremiah kind of got carried away because it still sort of was his job. At least he felt he was carrying out God's mandate in doing that. But for us, well, let me read one of my favorite verses here. 1 John 4:18, there is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves punishment, and the one who fears is not perfected in love. This is a great example of that two-edged sword that the word is. It doesn't mean just that you fear punishment. It means you fear someone else won't get punished. You have to let go of that whole thing. Step away from the scale altogether. When I told the single ladies to step away from the scale, they cheered me. So, you know, guys, forgiveness, I mean, if we didn't have anything else out of chapter 4 here, it's just to see the hurt and the bitterness and the anguish in Jeremiah's heart and to know we're not stuck there. We've been freed from that. That's the single biggest difference from us. And Jeremiah is freed from it now. I guarantee he understands what's going on right now. When we get home in heaven, we'll be partying with Jeremiah. But let's remember how important it is to forgive, not only because God is a God of forgiveness, but because he has commanded it, and because it blesses us and grows us spiritually to do it, and because it cripples us, our worship, our prayer, our communion, not to do it. Those are, any one of those would be enough. But all four of them together, we don't need to curse Edom, you guys, or those like her. We can forgive and trust God to do whatever is necessary to balance the scales of justice. And that is a glory and a freedom that only Christians have. Heavenly Father, Lord, we so thank you for the incomprehensible gifts you have given to us that even your people in the past did not understand. Lord, for sparing us the horrors and the traumas of a story like this, for promising to be with us whenever things like this even threaten, for being the one person in the universe who is worthy to be trusted, and for loving us enough to come rescue us out of this mess. Father, our thanks should pour out without ceasing. Please, Father, live in our hearts, make up for that lack, draw praise from our lips, draw love from our hearts, draw devotion from our spirits, and never, Father, never please cease to mold us, that we might one day stand completed in the image of your Son as we stand before you and worship. We love you. We thank you. In his name. Amen.